The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 13, The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor, and joining me as co-host is Curtis Armstrong. Hi, Curtis.
How are you doing, Edward?
I am great, thank you. People might notice I don't have the usual pipe tonight. Of course, if you've read the story, Sherlock's smoking a cigar throughout it, so I have to start at least.
Does this mean in one of the stories in which he smokes cigarettes, you would be smoking cigarettes?
No, because of the visual. Because people, it's funny because, you know, I'll smoke a cigar and people, or I'll smoke a pipe and people are like, "Ooh, look at all, that's really great. Oh, my grandfather used to smoke," and they love me. You smoke a cigar and unfortunately they think you're an obnoxious fat cat. So I don't usually do that. And if you smoke a cigarette, people get really upset. So,
and they even worse, don't even notice because everybody smokes cigarettes.
So that's so common now. But it is true that Sherlock smokes a lot of cigarettes in the story, as well as cigars and pipe. So he loves tobacco. So well, we're gonna talk about that when he does smoke the cigar today, but because that's what we do here on Sherlock Mondays, we deduce, decipher, dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective Sherlock Holmes and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson. And we do this in a kind of conversational annotation. If you're watching live right now, please like and subscribe to these videos and have fun in the live chat. That's always a great time. If you're watching the recording, also please like and subscribe these videos. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast, thank you for listening and leave a review. I would also ask everyone to please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. Thank you if you have already donated or joined as a member since the show has begun. That's really how we get to do this show, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you have not already donated or would like to make a further donation or become a member, which is up to you, I invite you to do so, and I thank you. Also, because doing Sherlock, Curtis, is also the history of Ed smoking and drinking, and this is what I do. What am I drinking tonight? Every episode. Yes, every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by our co-host Mary Alcaro, and this is the Golden Dowry, and Mary had it a little different than me. I adapted it. It's basically a champagne cocktail, but it's Prosecco instead of champagne. And she had recommended Goldschlager liqueur, because it's got the gold flakes in it, and vodka, and if you can get some gold edible sprinkles in it. I actually don't really like Goldschlager, so I didn't use it. I used Saint Germain, which I really like, and a little vodka. And you can see the rim is golden. I got one of those edible gold pens, and I painted the rim gold. So, but I'm afraid to put it on my lips, and I'll come away gold. So I have a little straw. It is in honor of, obviously, you know, the dowry, the gold dowry that Hattie brings to the noble bachelor, in which then he will not get a cent of, thank goodness. You can find the recipe in the YouTube description for this episode, and I also send out the recipe via email every week for those who are registered for the show. You can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage on rosenbeck.org. Curtis, since last you were, and we had a little bit of, you were on a little bit of a hiatus from this show.
I was, yes.
You were away. You were traveling the world, as you know, big shots do, enjoying yourself. And while you were away, another series of Moriarty came out on Audible, and you are in the new you were in the first series playing Inspector Gregson.
Right.
What's the sub? The Devil's Game? Is that the first one?
Yes.
And now there's a new one out, and you were in that as well.
I am, yes. Actually, even this wound up even being a larger role than the first one. So I was really excited and thrilled. I love the series. I think that they do an amazing job. All of the Easter eggs and the inside jokes, for those of us who really know the canon, are remarkable. It's just been a real treat to do them.
And it's a different take on Sherlock and Moriarty, obviously.
It's a different take. And, you know, when I first got the scripts for the first season, I thought, okay, well, it's, you know, darker and it's, you know, a different approach. But a lot of people do that. In this case, it's done supremely well. I mean, unusually well. And I just am knocked out by it.
Great. Well, I can't wait to hear the new one. And you can all find it on Audible. And I guess, is it also go out to other podcast platforms, or is it?
Yeah. Charlie Kindiger is the guy who wrote it and wrote the first series as well. And if you're a Sherlock Holmes fan, you'll really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. All righty. Well, our story today is The Noble Bachelor. Perhaps we should get to that. It's in a minute. We've also shared a PDF of a facsimile of The Noble Bachelor as it was originally published in the April 1892 issue of The Strand magazine. You can download that on the Rosenbeck's Sherlock Mondays page, because we'll look at a couple illustrations of that today. And it is adventure number 10. I keep talking about this with the other co-hosts, Curtis Howe. It's really emphasized in The Strand that these are adventure. It is the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And each story is not only the adventure number, and then it's also the adventure in the title of the story. We think of things differently in genres now than I think, you know, then. And now it's clearly a mystery detective story, but that's not quite a genre then. I think people have, you know, expectations when they hear adventure.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because in some of them, I can't remember now which ones exactly, but in some of the original Strand publications, there was a tendency to call them the adventure of the mystery of something. You know, it was sort of doubling down on it. And when it went into book publication, it was shrunk back to where it should have been, which was the adventure of.
Yeah.
And, you know, not including the mystery part. But, you know, certainly it was, you know, at the beginning, we were seeing something that was unique, or readers at the time were seeing something that was unique. The Strand magazine, in a lot of ways, was a unique publication. And the idea of every month this coming out with a new adventure was, you know, an inspired idea. And new for people.
Yeah, not something that, you know, Doyle invented, but he certainly popularizes this idea of the...
Well, and more to the point, the fact that the Strand was something that came out every month.
Yeah.
And there was a new story. It wasn't a continuation of a novel. It was a new story with recurring characters. And such compelling characters that it changed popular literature.
And they're
Sherlock Holmes, but The Strand.
And the stories are centered on people in England. And I just discovered this recently. When The Strand begins, they're serializing some French and, you know, Russian works. and they realize, no, our audience are, you know, very middle class, and middle class is huge. Right. People with money, they want to know about people here. And then they switch over, and Sherlock obviously taps right into that.
Absolutely.
And this story, like, well, we'll get into it. It's, you know, it's about the British aristocracy, even the Lord St. Simon marriage and its curious termination have long since ceased to be subject of interest in those exalted circles in which the unfortunate bridegroom moves. But fresh scandals have eclipsed it, and then more piquant details have drawn the gossips away from this four-year-old drama. It's fun. It sounds like, you know, this sounds like, you know, celebrity writing today, you know, scandal and gossip. And
well, I wish the writing today sounded that good.
Yes, the writing was as good.
That's one of the things that strikes me about Noble Bachelor is that, in the first place, it's coming after two of the most harrowing and grotesque of the early stories, which are The Speckled Band and The Engineer's Thumb. And on reading, as I often do, rereading The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from the, you know, from Scandal in Bohemia to Copper Beaches, one of the things that strikes me is that periodically something like Noble Bachelor comes up. And I think, although I don't know this and I've never really read anything about it, I have an idea that Doyle may have been thinking in terms of the fact that his reading public did not just consist of boys and men. And there were times when he needed to do a story that he felt would be more appropriate for the women readers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those stories, I think, one of the ones where he focuses on something. There's not violence. There's not, you know, anything ugly or harrowing about it. It's a story that is about the aristocracy, as you say, and about a marriage. And he does this periodically. Mm-hmm. And I think it was deliberate.
And Doyle uses a word in this first paragraph that makes that really I find interesting. It's the last sentence. I feel that no memoir of him, meaning of Sherlock, would be complete without some little sketch of this episode. And I know later we get the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes, but this idea early on that what we're reading are, yes, adventure stories, yes, mystery stories, but also a memoir of, and right, which becomes, I think, especially for me, as we're going through this project and doing these stories and seeing the way this relationship between these two are developing, that there is a very personal touch to these stories, the way Doyle is writing them through Watson as a memoir.
Right. Yes. I mean, it is that. Certainly, it is. I mean, really, the memoir is more Watson's memoir than anything else. And I think, I mean, it's certainly more than Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
It reminds me, when you bring that up, that when Study in Scarlet was published, something which is always, I've found interesting, part one, the beginning of the book, being a reprint from the reminiscences of Dr. John H. Watson, M.D., mm-hmm, late of them. So in the first place, it's describing this as a reprint,
yeah,
which means before this version of it that we all know, it had been published before,
yeah,
and it's the reminiscences of John H. Watson,
yeah,
which you imagine would be including the adventures, you know, his
time in the army and everything.
Exactly. And all of that. Well, this calls back to that as well. And you do sort of get a sense of wondering whether this is a memoir of Sherlock Holmes or a memoir of John H. Watson.
Yeah. Watson says it's a memoir of Sherlock, but you're right. It is. It's a memoir of Watson, and these are the things you know that happen. These mysteries happen. Sherlock happens.
Yes.
And he writes about them.
And it overtakes every other.
Just another way that Doyle, as a creator, has really, you know, hit upon the thing that is going to continue to be appealing to people and to really, I mean, work this. It's just magazine fiction, people. Like, I mean, really, when he's writing it, it's just some cheap magazine fiction, and he makes it something so much more. So, well, and one of the reasons why we read his and not others from that.
But at the time, it was just that.
Yeah.
It was just magazine fiction. What it has become is something that has been the result of generations of readers and people who, you know, take it much more seriously than they would have at the time.
Yeah. Well, Watson's certainly taking it seriously, and that's what I like. He reminds us again of his marriage. This episode is a few weeks before his marriage. So he's sharing the rooms with Holmes, so he doesn't have to stop by and then leave. He's already there. And he mentions the wound again. And this is interesting because this time the wound, he says, the Jezail bullet, which I had brought back in one of my limbs as a relic of my Afghan campaign, throbbed with dull persistency. Now, everybody, to take you back, in Study in Scarlet, he is shot in the shoulder. And that's what he tells us. And then in Sign of Four, he says he was shot in the leg. And so this is, you know, game for everybody why did that happen? But I wonder, is Doyle aware at this point that he had made that mistake? And so now he's just saying one of my limbs.
You know what I think? I think Doyle never thought about it.
Yeah.
I think he had forgotten where he had wounded Watson in the first story. And rather than go back and check it, he just put one of my limbs in to cover himself in. Because the funny thing is, in some of them, like, for example, in Sign of Four, when they're on that trek from the murder scene into London, that becomes part of that story about his description of their, you know, I think Holmes says to him, will your wound stand to, you know, something like that, to another, you know, a long walk, a 10-mile walk, whatever it is. So it was very much significant in those stories that he was wounded in the leg. In this story, they never go anywhere.
It
has nothing to do with anything except for the fact that he wants to set up the fact that he's been sitting all day, you know, however he says it. I actually kind of love the way he says it. With my body in one easy chair and my legs upon another, I've surrounded myself with a cloud of newspapers until at last, saturated with the news of the day, I toss them all aside and lay listless. So it's obviously that's a way of getting into the fact that he's about to pull out newspapers from weeks before to tell Holmes about the wedding. But it's also he's giving an excuse for why he's sitting around the apartment instead of out doing things.
Let's look at that picture too, the Sidney Paget illustration here. Here they are. It's very domestic in one way, that, you know, these two men share in these rooms here, but Watson in the relaxed pose with his hands up here, I guess this is Sherlock's hat on the table.
He's just come in and put it down on the table to open up the note from Sir Robert.
The papers all around, just lounging around in their rooms.
Yeah.
The early Sherlock. Although Paget from the beginning has Sherlock balding some. That starts it's very eating. Early.
Let's say receding.
Receding. There you go. it doesn't matter to me. But you know, but there he is. That was the first scene in here. Watson sees all the correspondence for Holmes there, and one of them has a huge crest and a monogram, and he comments, oh, you've gotten a fashionable letter this time. Others, you know, were from fishmongers and a tide waiter, and Sherlock says, yes, my correspondence certainly has the charm of variety that he has clients, and this has been happening from studying Scarlet that Watson noticed all the people visiting him, that it's right. All over the societal spectrum. Holmes isn't just the detective for the rich who can pay him.
Right. That's very true, yeah. It's funny because my correspondent certainly has the charm of variety, and the humbler are usually the more interesting. And there are a number of cases, moments in this story, which maybe it was because he was writing a bit about the upper class here, have a kind of almost Oscar Wildean quality to some of the banter back and forth between Holmes and Watson. Which I love, and it's something that because of the sort of the type of writing that this is, because it's not a big adventure story, there's a lot of room for Watson to really sort of spread himself when it comes to being a writer. And I love that, the fact that, for example, one of my favorite moments in this story is coming up, which is Holmes has told Watson he needs the information from all of these newspapers, which miraculously Watson has kept newspapers going back weeks for some reason. That's a whole other question. But then as he's reading, as he's got everything set up in order, in chronological order, from all of these newspapers, and he's reading them to Holmes, and he finally gets to a break, and Holmes says, anything else? Asked Holmes, yawning, because this is of no interest to him whatsoever. And Watson says, oh, yes, plenty. And I love that. It's three words, but what it says is Watson digs this.
Yeah.
Watson loves all of this high society, marriage, scandal stuff. And it could explain why he's kept all of these newspapers for that length of time.
Uh-huh.
The way that it's set up in the beginning of the story, it makes it sound like this is an unusual day, which is why he has all the newspapers. But only when Holmes makes him tell the story do you realize that he's kept all of these newspapers going back for weeks.
Yeah.
And I think that's lovely.
I wonder if he's just a messy bachelor. Just everything.
Well, I mean, Watson is the one who supposedly always complains to Holmes about
Sherlock being a mess. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he suggests in I think it's Gloria Scott, he suggests to Holmes that he might take a few moments to make their living quarters more comfortable because of his sloppiness and his, you know, stuff lying all over
mm-hmm.
so forth. But Watson's the one with, you know, the Morning Post going back 4 weeks.
Let's back up a moment. The letter that Sherlock gets is, you know, from Lord Robert St. Simon, which I want to mention in a second, his naming. But it begins, my dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Lord Backwater tells me, and I'm thinking, like, is that a joke? Like, Lord Backwater is funny, but it's actually a name that I've seen actually in real life.
And he appears again in this in the canon.
Yes, he does. And it is from Saint Simon. This is a painful event has occurred, and he's not only been referred by Lord Backwater, but also by Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard.
Sort of referred.
Yeah, so he has, you know, he can, but it's the Lord Backwater thing, is that Lord Saint Simon, Robert Saint Simon, is the person who he has to get a recommendation from another member of his class before he can, I think, go to Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
The letter is signed. Now, people may have a different version of this. Mine in the original Strand is actually just signed Saint Simon. But that's wrong, apparently. And I got this from Leslie Klinger, and then yeah. I went down a rabbit hole of looking up names of these, and because is as a second son of a duke, is it, or an earl? As a second son, he would have been Lord Robert Saint Simon.
That's correct.
And actually the Lord is just an honor. It's just a courtesy term. He's not technically what you call a lord. That's just an honorary name that is given to the younger sons of dukes and marquesses. They're called Lord, and then their first name and last name, and they don't vary that stuff. That's, you know, so.
Well, there was actually a misprint. The one that you're talking about, Saint Simon, was incorrect in the Strand.
Yes.
It's also incorrect in the American editions.
Yeah, in the very first printings, and then it's changed and the Robert is added.
Robert St. Simon, yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing about the naming is if you go through Les Klinger's book, which everybody should have who's interested in Sherlock Holmes, the thing that's interesting about it is that this story has in it triggers of the naming is one, because you're dealing with a high society family. There are tons of different articles that have been written and annotations in various books about what is right and what is wrong when it comes to making reference to the names of the aristocracy, as in this case. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that you talk about a rabbit hole. You can go down forever when it comes to that. And just in general, the families, the crests of the families have been, you know, written about endlessly in the Sherlockian world.
Yeah, Holmes looks that up. Holmes looks up the crest, and I found online, this was just a Wikimedia Commons image that someone made, and this is the, and here it is. I will share it here with the.
With the caltrops.
Yeah, the caltrops here, and, you know, it's all azure, and then is it a fess is the line going across, a fess, say, and it's sable, it's black. So this,
you
is
know,
the arms
I'll
look.
Tell you, of all of the things in Sherlockian exegesis, the one thing that I find myself unable to get interested in is this very subject. I think that if people are interested in that, they're it's endless, the fascination.
Well,
if you don't get it, you don't get it.
And Holmes too. He reads all this out. He reads it in the book, and he's like, "Well, there's nothing instructive in this. There is nothing instructive in all this," is what Sherlock says about that.
Yeah.
And he wants, tell me what's in the newspapers. He says something more solid is what Watson can give him from the newspapers. And I like that too, because the newspaper is the popular medium, and Sherlock is saying that's more useful than the official peerage book with the coat of arms, that this is really telling us about people.
Well,
this
Watson, doesn't.
Yeah.
Watson is his Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if this story were being written today, instead of being surrounded by a cloud of newspapers, Watson would have been scrolling all day. You know, that's how he would have been killing time. But in those days, it was newspapers.
Yep.
And it was all different kinds of newspapers. There's a whole ream of different articles about just the kind of articles, the newspapers that Watson is making reference to here. There are conservative ones, politically conservative ones. There are ones that are social sort of scandal rags.
Mm-hmm.
It's the works. He's got everything there.
And there's so many. There's 8 or 10 morning newspapers. There's afternoon newspapers. There's, you know, 8 or 10 evening papers that come out. There's weekly papers that come out. So there's you know, it's, and what's the technology too? It's, you know, the printing is cheap then, and right. And the newspapers are all competing with each other, and you know, the Times I think is maybe the most expensive at 6 or 7 cents an issue or something, and then but then the penny papers come out and they start to take over, and they're even more popular because right. they're penny. And this is the medium that Holmes needs to consult to really find out the basic
it
info.
It happens often in the stories where he has gotten, in fact, in Silver Blaze, which is another story in which Lord Backwater appears, there's another case where Holmes says, I need, you know, what is the information about this? He does it frequently.
Well, I just have to mention it just because I have to mention them all. There is another unpublished case mentioned here. You mean the little problem of the Grosvenor Square furniture van? We're not getting that story. I'm not sure
how exciting. We'll ever get.
I'm not sure how exciting the furniture van mystery was, but Watson chose not to share it. He said, this isn't an interesting one. I'm not going to share it. And here's his newspaper report, kind of, you know, in encapsulated. First, it is that Lord Robert St. Simon, second son of the Duke of Balmoral, and Miss Hattie Duran, the only daughter of Aloysius Duran, Esquire of San Francisco, California, USA. And the Esquire means he made money. And this is the way the British, it's a title he can give himself in a place where titles matter.
Well, but the thing that confuses me about that was that I thought Esquire was just, I've always thought that it was just something that was tacked on that you could do if you had a lot of money. But I've been told since, and I don't know if it's true, that Esquire is something which at this time was only applicable if you were a lawyer. And that it was connected with the law as opposed to just money.
Hmm.
I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm throwing it out there.
I think it's a class distinction then. And I think it actually becomes a distinction that lawyers then kind of use always. When I was a kid, my father was a lawyer, and we always got a kick that we would say his name. We would say, my dad, John J. Pettit, Esquire. Like, we would say that all the time. We would tell people because we thought it was cool that he had a little title thing. But actually, I think that as it evolves, it does become associated only with lawyers. But I'm pretty sure at this time, it is people, especially in this time when all this class movement is happening, when people get money, that's one of the ways that they use.
The other thing that could be was, this is a guy who made all of his money in the mines.
Mm-hmm.
He is a newcomer to England. He could reinvent himself when he comes to England by calling himself Esquire, whether he is or not.
Yeah.
Especially if he's trying to unload his daughter to, you know, somebody in the upper class in England. Rather than just be Aloysius Duran.
Yeah, he's not Al Duran Minor. He's, you know,
exactly.
Because he's taken the money and then he's invested it in all kinds of other things and become even richer. And that's
so he's rich.
The Esquire, you know, hobnobbing with the financial people.
Right.
Well, that's the marriage or the engagement announcement. And then Watson, and I love this part about the newspaper account. Then Watson's reading from the paper. One by one, the management of the noble houses of Great Britain is passing into the hands of our fair cousins from across the Atlantic. An important addition has been made during the last week to the list of prizes which have been borne away by these charming invaders.
Yes.
And this is a real issue. These kind of American, you know, these American women who were in rich families are starting to seriously marry into and in not small numbers marry into the British aristocracy because they're all out of money.
Yeah.
These titled lords have been living on their lands for centuries and their lands no longer support them like it did when it was an agricultural, you know.
Well, and Lord Robert is one of the prime examples of somebody who is really marrying Hattie for her money, literally yeah. marrying her for her money. And Hattie is marrying him for his nobility, supposedly.
She gets a title, he gets the cash to maintain the trappings of his title.
That's right.
And her dowry will run considerably over the six figures. And just that little piece of newspaper ends. It is obvious that the Californian heiress is not the only gainer by an alliance which will enable her to make the easy and common transition from Republican lady to a British title. I like that this is I don't think Lord St. Simon would say it's an easy and common transition, but certainly a journalist in a newspaper thinks that that is the case.
Right. Right. And just parenthetically, you were talking about the title, Lord St. Simon, and how many people say that he was not being correctly addressed. He's called Lord St. Simon by everyone in this story,
yeah.
including in the newspaper. So the mistake is widespread.
Yeah, the mistake winds up being with nobody's giving him quite his...
Nobody got it right. Holmes calls him the wrong title, Watson does, and the newspapers do. So...
And then Watson gives him the, you know, why this story is interesting... That, you know, these are all the notices which appeared before the disappearance of the bride. Before the what? asked Holmes with a start. The vanishing of the lady. And then, when did she vanish then? At the wedding breakfast. Indeed, this is more interesting than it promised to be. Quite yeah, dramatic, in fact. So this is the kind of story that, this is the kind of case that Sherlock will like. But
right. Yes. And then... We get it back into the Wildean banter, where he says they often vanish before the ceremony and occasionally during the honeymoon. But I cannot recall to mind anything quite so prompt as this.
That's a Wildean line right there.
It is. I mean, those things do pop up here. And another thing that I just noted when I was going through it because I like it so much is when Lord Robert St. Simon arrives at the house. And by the way, the page boy announces him as Lord Robert St. Simon. So the page boy may be the only one in the story who actually gets it right. But but he throws open the door. This is just such good writing in the style of this particular story. A gentleman entered with a pleasant, cultured face, high-nosed and pale, with something perhaps of petulance about the mouth, and with the steady, well-opened eye of a man whose pleasant lot it has ever been to command and to be obeyed. I mean, that's just great. I just love that.
Slightly foppish, but
it's perfect for this story.
But the dripping with irony.
Oh, there's a lot of that.
is great to have from Doyle. And that kind of idea that Doyle understands his reading audience. He knows that the audience for The Strand wants you to kind of take the mickey a bit out of, you know, these people who command these people who command you to obey them.
Yes, absolutely true. I mean, and he doesn't do Lord Robert any favors. He makes him astoundingly snotty and snobby, to the point that he says, indeed, you say there was a gentleman in the pew. Some of the general public were present then. And he went, and Lord Robert says, oh, yes, it is impossible to exclude them when the church is open. I mean, you know, you just want this guy to fail from the beginning. He's such a snob.
Well, their first conversation is, he tells Holmes, I presume that they, his other clients, were hardly from the same class of society. And Sherlock says, what? No, I am descending. I beg pardon? Yeah. My last client of the sort was a king. Oh, really? I had no idea. And which king? It's the king of Scandinavia. What? Had he lost his wife? And then Holmes is like, well, you can understand. I extend I extend to the affairs of my other clients the same secrecy which I promised to you in yours. So that's another great little exchange there that's,
it's full of them, this story. There's a lot of wonderful writing.
So he's here, and Holmes wants to question him. I love how Holmes asks, Holmes shows him the article in the newspaper and says, is this right? And he says, yes, that is correct as far as it goes, and that the newspaper has it right. And now Holmes needs to ask him questions to kind of get the little finer points that he knows will, you know, lead to him solving this. And he's, and again, well, like, I'm not going to say, but he does. He solves it immediately.
Yes.
He doesn't even need to smoke his pipe for this one.
No.
Maybe that's why it's a cigar in this story, because he didn't even need to smoke a pipe to figure anything out. Some of the things that he tells her is the Lord tells Holmes is that I was amused by her society, and she could see that I was amused.
I mean, just you want to slap him, don't you?
Yeah. And she was also a free spirit. She ran free in a mining camp and wandered through woods or mountains. But he wants to assure Sherlock that I would not have given her my name, which I have the honor to bear. He gave a little stately cough. And I now thought her to be at bottom a noble woman, that he's got to justify making her, because he's the noble bachelor. He has to justify making her the noble bride.
Right.
He shows a picture to Sherlock, and I love this because this is what Watson would do, I would think. It was a little ivory, and Holmes gazed long and earnestly at it. That's interesting. Now, we know Holmes is very asexual. That's not his real interest, or is it? But the idea that he would be kind of captivated by her.
Doesn't Watson describe her as having an exquisite mouth?
Yes.
Which is kind of extreme, I think, for even for Watson. It's really, I don't know.
Holmes checks her out too, before he gives the miniature back. And then Holmes mentions the dowry. She brought, I understand, a considerable dowry, a fair dowry, not more than is usual in my family. Your family's broke. Now he's just lying, because the only reason he would marry her is he needs this money. This is why these marriages occur. And what's interesting, the story never, like, the story doesn't give any evidence for what I just said. The story doesn't, you never find out that he suddenly has no money, but
you do get a sense at the end.
It's always hinted at. And I think you only need to hint at it because I think the audience, and especially the readership at the time, understands that this is going on.
At the very end of the story, though, Holmes says, "Ah, Watson, perhaps you would not be very gracious either if, after all the trouble of wooing and wedding, you found yourself deprived in an instant of wife and of fortune."
Yes.
So that's putting it out there.
Well, he's been deprived of a fortune, but there's no evidence that he really needs it, but he does need it. And I think that kind of sentence and everything else we get in the story just hint at it constantly, that he's only marrying her because he needs the money. He mentions that now this is when he tells about the incident in the church, that she dropped her bouquet and it was, you know, given to her by a gentleman. Holmes asks when Holmes asks about people attending, when you quoted that the quite a common looking person thing that he was there, Holmes says, he also says, "But really, I think that we are wandering rather far from the point," says Lord St. Simon. Like, he can't get why Holmes is asking these questions.
Right.
But we, as readers of Sherlock Holmes stories, should know now that this is calling attention to these are the points that you need to pay attention to.
Right.
She has a rather, her, the Hattie has a servant who takes two great liberties, according to the Lord. But that's the way Americans do it.
They think differently about these sorts of things there.
And he says, "Lady St. Simon said something about jumping a claim," which he doesn't get. And Holmes has the really funny response, "American slang is very expressive sometimes." That's like a Wildian line.
It's actually great because he says that then, but never follows up on what he means.
Yes.
Till the end of the story.
Yes.
He describes to Watson what jumping a claim means.
Uh-huh.
But when it happens, you don't know.
And I would imagine a lot of people have heard that term. I didn't look it up to see if it was a specifically American mining term, because
sounds so American.
Because the British had this whole rush for gold in Australia already. So, you know, I wonder if they're not also aware. And in Africa, they had these too. So I wonder if they aren't aware of the job. Well, I don't know. Well, that's a good one to find out. Maybe someone knows and could tell me. And then St. Simon tells him about the woman that came in, that she was who interrupted the wedding breakfast, Flora Miller, and had to be thrown out. And he wants to, of course, downplay his relationship with her. "We have been on a friendly footing. I may say on a very friendly footing, but I have not treated her ungenerously."
In other words, he paid her off.
Yeah, which is what she was his mistress, spending time with her, and then, you know, said, "You're not going to have anything more from me. Here's some money. Go away. I'm going to get married." And she doesn't, you know, she doesn't agree.
Well, she doesn't agree, but what she doesn't realize is she's playing a game and she doesn't know the rules of the game. He knows the rules of the game, mm-hmm. which is, you are my plaything as long as I choose to make you my plaything. And when I'm done, I'll pay you off and you'll take it.
And you're not my plaything if you have a rich father who will provide me with a dowry. So, because this dancer is of no different class than right. Hattie Doran began with as well. Yeah. Well, let me take a moment here to thank everyone for watching or listening to Sherlock Mondays. The Rosenbach's community reaches all around the globe, brought together by our love for the history, rare books, manuscripts, and the arts. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, and exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. And part of membership is early access to program and course registration. And there are lots of great in-person programs and also online programs and courses that are that have just been posted on the Rosenbach's website. The members can begin registering for these things on December 14th, 2023, this is, and the general public can start registering on January 3rd. So you have a few weeks to register first. If you're a member, there are courses on Dracula, online course, which I am teaching. There is a which I get to share all the great Bram Stoker material we have at the Rosenbach, all the notes for Dracula. There's a weekly course on James Joyce's Ulysses, which starts in February and leads up to Bloomsday. There is an online course on Robert Burns' poetry, because we have one of the great Robert Burns collections in the world. There's also a great Burns Night celebration we do in person on January 25th at the Rosenbach. And there's an online course on Virginia Woolf that will happen this winter as well. And just to remind everybody, at this time of year when we're live streaming in December, Rosenbach membership makes a great gift. I can't stress how important your support is. So if you haven't made a donation yet or joined as a member or have the ability to make a further donation, I would be very grateful. Coming up on the next episode, on episode 14, we will have a couple special guests, and that will be Scott Monty and Bert Walder of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere podcast. They're going to come visit us before we talk about the Blue Carbuncle and talk about Sherlockian podcasting. Curtis, I'm sure you know Scott and Bert.
Do indeed.
They are going to be great. And they've been doing their podcast for 17 years.
A splendid podcast it's been, too.
It is the first place that I go to look up Sherlockian things and to learn. I mean, after the books, obviously, to learn things. I learned so much out of those guys. They're really great and a lot of fun. And I was on a I Hear of Sherlock episode. Actually, the current I Hear Sherlock Everywhere episode I am on, talking about Sherlock Mondays. You can look them up online. And the last thing I wanted to let people know that the other BiblioVenture I'm doing right now is called Pickwick Monthly, in which we go through Charles Dickens's Pickwick Papers, one serial part per month. And this month, because Dickens, when he originally wrote it, also paid attention to the time of year he was writing it. His characters were, you know, in the same season as his readers. And it's the Christmas issue. And number 10 is the Christmas at Dingley Dell that the Pickwickians celebrate, and we get the great goblins who stole a sexton story.
And I've been so inspired by this, I've decided I'm going to reread Pickwick Papers starting next week.
Great. Well, and this is an easy show to do too, because even if you haven't, you know, read all of Pickwick Papers yet, it's an adventure of the week, adventure of the month kind of story. So you can jump in at any time. And it's very easy to jump in for this next episode, which will air live on Saturday, December 16th at 2 p.m. Eastern time in the afternoon. And if you can't watch it then, you can just watch the replay on the Pickwick Monthly playlist on the Rosenbach's YouTube channel. And it's just a lot of fun. I love doing Christmas Eve. I'll have the Pickwick Monthly Christmas, and then I have the Sherlock Mondays with the Blue Carbuncle just a couple days later. So I get to indulge a lot in the Yule season. One of my favorite. I don't have this beard for nothing, everybody. So it'll be fun. Well, that's it. Let's get back to the story. You love Pickwick Papers too, Curtis. I know that.
Yeah, I do. I've read it many, many times.
I have to get you to the Philadelphia Pickwick Club one of these seasons.
One day.
All right. All right. So his Saint Simon's account of Flora Mill is very condescending. You know, she doesn't matter to him, but why would she? Because, you know, he's paid her off, right? they have they throw her out of the place. It's actually it was in the original story. It says that two police fellows there in private clothes threw her out, but then Doyle realized that they were servants, and so they had to change the thing in the story. The newspaper article earlier said it was a butler and a footman who escorted her out, and that's the way Paget drew it. So when this was published later in book form, he changed two police fellows to given instructions to the servants to throw her out. So, and then Lestrade. This is what Lestrade says. Holmes asks him what does he think about all of this? First Saint Simon says Lestrade thinks it's serious that Flora is involved. Obviously, if this is Lestrade's theory, we know that it's not the right one. And then Holmes asks for Saint Simon's own theory, and his. His reason for her disappearing was that she must have gone crazy because she married me.
This is a delusional man.
Yeah.
On many levels, I think.
Consciousness that she made so immense a social stride had the effect of causing some little nervous disturbance in my wife. So, you've got a cat stalking up there behind you.
Yes, there's nothing that. I can do about that.
Oh, I love it. So, yes. What everybody's pet winds up making some appearance on the shows. So, what's his name?
His name's Cooper.
Cooper.
Yeah.
So that's Lord Saint Simon, so full of himself, thinks that he must have deranged her by just his presence. And then he says, should you be fortunate enough to solve this problem? And Holmes says, I have solved it. What was that? I say, I have solved it. Well, then, where then is my wife? That is the detail which I shall speedily supply, because Holmes has to, do the big reveal, right? I can't just tell you the solution. I have to tie up all the loose ends.
Story, would there? I mean, not if he told him at this point.
Yes. So, and it's odd because, and you talk about that wouldn't be a story. Like, there's really no mystery in this one. Just as the previous episode when we did Engineer's Thumb, it's someone comes in, tells a story, and then they just go and see the end of it. Sherlock has it's really about the tale itself.
And that's true in a lot of the cases of Sherlock Holmes, the early ones and the later ones, where you can see where Doyle came up with a great story, but couldn't figure out a way to put Holmes in it. So he just sticks him in as an observer, basically. And that happens a lot.
And this is one, he does kind of write the first batch of six stories at once. And then he writes the second batch kind of at once, but he's writing all the time. He's publishing lots of other stories in the magazines. He's researching and writing his historical novels.
Right.
Just look them up sometime. The number of stories that he's written, it's in the hundreds, and that had published in his life. It's just, he has ideas all the time. Every month he's got a story or two.
A professional writer.
Yeah.
For the time. And he was writing for magazines, he was writing for book publication, he was writing plays, even, God help us, he was writing poetry. He was constantly writing one thing or another.
Well, St. Simon leaves, and now Holmes says, I think that I shall have a whiskey and soda and a cigar after all this cross-questioning. So,
and I'm having the whiskey and soda, and you're having the cigar.
I'll have the cigar. You have the whiskey and soda. I have my golden dowry to go with it here.
And it's at this point where he starts to list all of the similar cases.
Yes.
Why he's able to come up with the solution so quickly.
Which is fascinating. He relies on his own crime files that he's been putting together. So it's not like he's like, oh, I figured it out so much. It's that I've seen this before, right?
And he talks about there was a parallel incident in Aberdeen and one much along the same lines at Munich, the year after the Franco-Prussian War. What's interesting to me, and I noted this before, was that the one case that he doesn't mention that has striking similarities is a case of identity, which has appeared just earlier in the book. And in this scene with Lestrade, where he's talking to Lestrade, baiting Lestrade, he says, "Just one hint to you, Lestrade," drawled Holmes before his rival had vanished. "I will tell you the true solution of the matter. Lady St. Simon is a myth. There is not, and there never has been, any such person." And that was exactly the same case in Case of Identity, where Hosmer Angel never existed.
Yeah.
It's a different side of the marriage equation who was dropping out, but it still is very strongly suggested.
I also can't miss, especially because it's another American reference in this story. Doyle just has America on his mind in this, you know, writing this story. When he mentions about circumstantial evidence is occasionally very convincing, as when you find a trout in the milk, to quote Thoreau's example.
Yes.
And for people wondering, that is, you know, Thoreau did use that as the Thoreau line, Henry David Thoreau line in his journal in 1850 was, "Some circumstantial evidence is very strong, as when you find a trout in the milk," which refers to the fact that if you think the farmer has diluted your milk with water, you know it when you find a trout, because he was dipping the milk can and then a trout jumped in accidentally. So it's the circumstantial evidence that proves that the farmer was diluting your milk before you bought it from him. And that's odd that Holmes is reading Thoreau in 18, you know, whatever it is, the end of the 19th century. That's a rabbit hole that I just didn't have time to go down.
Well, he does that a lot, though. He's constantly, even in the earliest stories, he's quoting writers, sometimes obscure writers.
It's the Thoreau one that I wondered about. I didn't know how popular Thoreau was in England and how common a name that would have been. But the fact that Doyle uses it in a throwaway like this answers my question, right? That people did know who Thoreau was.
Yeah.
Lestrade arrives, as you said, and for Holmes, it's the knowledge of pre-existing cases that allow him to figure this out. But Lestrade has been dragging the river for the bride's body. And but even with Holmes laughing at him for doing this, Lestrade has a revelation, and he's got the bag with all of the wedding clothes and the wedding ring in the bag.
I don't understand. I can understand throwing the clothes in the river, but how did they find the ring? I mean, the clothes would be easy; they'd be floating. But if she took the ring off and threw it in the river, they found that.
Well, I like that she does throw the ring away too, so that this isn't.
I mean, it's just weird that they were able to find it. They did.
It could have been in a pocket because the note was in a pocket.
That's true.
And Lestrade also finds a note. And, you know, Holmes had another great line here. Of course, Lestrade says they were identified as her clothes. "It seemed to me that if the clothes were there, the body would not be far off." And Holmes says, "By the same brilliant reasoning, every man's body is to be found in the neighborhood of his wardrobe."
Right. So,
He's on fire for this story.
It's pure wild.
Doyle is just having so much fun with this one. In the dress, there was a pocket. In the pocket is a card case. In the card case is a note from Lestrade. And the note says, "You will see me when all is ready. Come at once, FHM." And of course, Flora Miller, who broke in, there's two of her initials there. So Lestrade thinks he has solved it. And Holmes, of course, takes the note and says, "Oh, this is important." And Lestrade says, "You're looking at the wrong side." Well, this is the right side, because the note is a bill from a hotel. October 4th, rooms, 8 shillings, breakfast, 2 shillings, sixpence, cocktail, 1 shilling, lunch, 2 shillings, sixpence, glass of sherry, 8 pence. And that's what's written on the note. But that's the clue that Holmes needs to find the missing bride, or not bride.
He was the bride still. I mean, she...
It's not a spoiler. We've all read the story, but she's already married. So she's not, like, she can't be married again. So... yeah, that's there's no Lady St. Simon, because you couldn't possibly marry him because he's already married. That's when Holmes gives him that line, and then he tells Watson he has to leave. And while he's gone, arrived a confectioner's man with a very large flat box, a little cold supper. I like that. This makes me hungry when I read this. Couple of brace of cold woodcock, a pheasant, a pâté foie gras pie.
Which I made once.
Oh, yeah?
I did for a January 6th birthday, Sherlock Holmes birthday dinner that I made for myself because I had no one to celebrate with. I looked up a foie gras pie in a cookbook and made it myself.
Wow. And did it turn out?
It turned out.
You weren't? I never
made it again.
All righty, I'm refilling my golden dowry here. A group of ancient and cobwebby bottles. So this delicious little cold supper arrives, and while Watson is waiting, Lord St. Simon shows up. Holmes comes first. Yes. So then Holmes comes, and two visitors. Two visitors vanished away. Holmes steps in the room. Good. They've laid for five. So now we're expecting company. That's what I was trying to remember here. They're expecting company. And then St. Simon arrives, and we get this kind of we're kind of teased by what Holmes has already told him. He says right away, "Have you good authority for what you say to Holmes, and the best possible?" But we don't know yet. Or the reader of the story for the first time doesn't know what's going on here, why this has happened. Although, again, this is a fair play mystery, isn't it? This is a mystery that you are given all the facts and you could conceivably solve it. If you're as brilliant as Sherlock.
Hard to know after all this time, but...
What's that?
It's hard to know. We're so familiar with these stories that it's hard to know whether you could figure it out.
But all the clues are there. So for the author, they know that they've given you everything that, you know, this is in the chain. Now, of course, who knows how you're going to connect dots, because we all connect dots differently. But Sherlock always connects the right dots. Takes the right picture. Holmes is siding with the bride right away, right? Simon says, "What will the Duke say when he hears that one of the family has been subjected to such a humiliation?" And Holmes's answer is, "I fail to see that anyone is to blame. I can hardly see how the lady could have failed. I can hardly see how the lady could have acted otherwise, though her abrupt method of doing it was undoubtedly to be regretted. Having no mother, she had no one to advise her at such a crisis." And all Simon's concerned with is, he says, "It was a slight, sir. a public slight. It was a slight, sir, a public slight. I mean, you know, I can't imagine how snottily he, you know, said that. But Holmes wants to make an allowance for this poor girl placed in so unprecedented a position. I mean, I love that Holmes is on her side right away and not on the side of the titled Lord. And, you know, you read lots of, I mean, it's interesting to read the fiction in the 19th century that everybody does, you know, kowtow to the, you know, to the titled people. And also fiction, Dickens, I think primarily where he's constantly making fun of them. It's rare to have aristocrats in Dickens's works that they're not making fun of. And Doyle, I think he does both. It just depends on the work that he's doing, because he is a writer, especially once you get to his historical fiction, who really believes in this kind of nobility of people, that some people have a noble nature that they have been born with. And that doesn't, they may have been born poor too, but they have this kind of thing about them. But for the class system that, and I think it's especially due to, he knows his audience for this story, for the Sherlock stories, that he can really make fun of Simon and take the side of the other people. Well, now everyone arrives, the bride arrives, and Sherlock introduces the Mr. and Mrs., like they're coming to their wedding, like, and let me introduce you for the first time, Mr. and Mrs. Francis A. Moulton. The lady, I think, you have already met. Again, a little, like, that's funny that he says that.
I mean, it really is a dig. And I mean, one of the things that is commented on in the annotated versions is that the meal that's been laid out for this gathering, we would assume was for five people. That's what Watson says. You've laid for five people. In fact, people who know this sort of thing better than I have pointed out that the food that was laid out was actually for only four. That the brace of woodcock, the pheasant, and the pâté de foie gras pie would not have been enough for five people. And therefore, Holmes would have suspected that Lord Robert St. Simon would not have been staying to indulge in the dinner.
Well, it's certainly easier to cut a pie in four, which is how I like to cut a pie. I know everybody likes to do the slice. I'm just like, just cut it in four and we'll go start from there.
Well, I suppose that's true.
The St. Simon is completely offended that they're even there. He springs from his seat, his eyes cast down and his hand thrust into the breast of his frock coat, a picture of offended dignity. He wants no parts of this, you know, woman who has slighted him publicly to come in and to be with her at all. And it's her husband, Frank, who's Frank, he wants no more secrecy. He says, let's lay it all out on the table. If I may give opinion, we've had just a little too much secrecy over this business already. He's described as a small, wiry, sunburned, clean shaven, with a sharp face and alert manner. Which interesting is, clean shaven was then cut out, like Doyle edited clean shaven out of the rest of the later editions. And I don't know why. It's an odd thing to cut out.
It's a weird thing.
Yeah. But he was clean shaven, everyone, just so you know. Maybe he's just even emphasizing that he's a gentleman, that, you know, he understands how to present himself to people.
But Lord Robert had a mustache.
He does. So maybe the Americans are clean shaven and the Brits still have facial hair. Maybe that's a thing that's going on still then. I don't know. Maybe the Americans have already stopped it with the beards and the mustaches in the 19th century, and they're starting to become clean shaven. And the Brits,
but
though.
Why would he then omit it? It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know. We get Hattie's story now, how she met him, and, you know, but she couldn't marry. It's interesting. She couldn't marry Frank because he had no money, because he was poor still. He hadn't made his claim. He hadn't hit it, struck it rich yet. But so her dad wouldn't let her marry him. He's waiting for a better offer. And that's what she eventually, that's what they eventually get. And then her and Frank, though, marry in secret. And then she thinks Frank has been killed by the Apache Indians who have attacked a miners' camp, and his name is listed among the dead. So that's why she goes ahead with the wedding. And it's interesting. She says, if I had married Lord St. Simon, of course, I'd have done my duty by him. We can't command our love, but we can our actions. I would make him just as good a wife as it was in me to be. And she winds up, and I think this is Doyle's intention, she winds up being the of that couple, the Lord St. Simon and her, she's the one with the true nobility, right?
Absolutely.
She's the one.
And strangely, that's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
But when he says it, it comes out bad because he's snotty about it. But the truth is, that is, you're absolutely
yes.
right. He's
yeah.
the one with the absolute nobility of soul.
Also, it is then, and she also said, she also said, should I stop the service and make a scene in the church? Again, her showing that, you know, I actually think that I shouldn't make a scene for you. I should try to slip out later. She says, it seemed to me from the little I heard as if he had a little secret of his own before marriage also, and this is Flora Miller. So she kind of throws that at him, that like, look, I had a secret and I should have told you beforehand, I get it, and you had a secret too that also showed up at our wedding, just yeah. as my secret showed up at our yeah. wedding.
Yeah.
Well, he's not going to be, you know, he's not going to be charmed by this, you know, by her anymore. I mean, he only has a liking for her. What's his line? Their kind of amiable, you know, ness is all they really have together anyway. They're not in love, clearly. He's not in love with her. So this isn't a story of, you know, he's lost the love of his life, anything like that. And she, Lord St. Simon says, it is not my custom to discuss my most intimate personal affairs in this public manner, is his answer to her. And then she says, won't you forgive me? Won't you shake hands before I go? Oh, certainly, if it would give you any pleasure. And he put out his hand and coldly grasped that which she extended to him. That he will only do what social
decorum. Bare minimum.
Yeah. This is what I have to do, so I'll do it. But then he refuses supper. Come on. This sounds like a nice cold supper. And he refuses that. Holmes, though, is happy that they're going to stay. Hattie and Frank are going to stay. And then he has this really curious little passage here. He says, it is always a joy to me to meet an American, Mr. Moulton, for I am one of those who believe that the folly of a monarch and the blundering of a minister in far gone years will not prevent our children from being someday citizens of the same worldwide country under a flag which shall be a quartering of the Union Jack with the stars and stripes.
I don't even know what to make of that.
I mean, it's a weirdly political statement in a sense for Holmes to make.
Yeah.
But it's also, if you really look at it, what he's saying is one day there will be a worldwide country, which you could call an empire, which is just America and Great Britain ruling the entire world. That's troubling.
Yeah.
Like we know that Doyle is pro empire, and but he also shows the problems with it that happen. But I don't want Sherlock Holmes to be pro empire.
Well, I guess you could say that he allowed for the pro-empire side, but refused to make him pro-spiritualist. So there are different elements involved.
But also that Holmes really likes Americans, has, you know, his American cousin.
That may be another tip of that, of, you know, his sense of his readership.
Yeah.
At that point, was wanting to, you know, give the Americans a little, throw them a bone, and make them feel good about themselves.
Yeah. Holmes, now to finish this, he loves doing this, and this is the thing, you know, this is from the post Dupin stories that, you know, Doyle has learned. Now I'm going to tell you how I figured this out. And, you know, and it's, you know, this is what, two facts were obvious to me. Number one, she was willing to undergo the ceremony. And number two, she repented of it within a few minutes of returning home. So who did she see that could have changed her mind? Must have been America. She doesn't know anybody here. And he goes through the whole deductive reasoning of it. This is, you know, explaining his men. This is what stories are about. This is the... What Edgar Allan Poe called the when he writes his Dupin stories, is a story in a new key, and this is the central element of a mystery detective story. It's explaining this, and this is odd for this one because it's not a real mystery detective story. So Doyle's kind of got to attach it onto the end of this story that has gone on, which in a way for me shows that even just any story, if you just figure it out on your own with only knowing a few of the facts, is in a sense you solving a mystery. Figuring out anything is solving the mystery of how this thing came about. Does that work at all?
I think when he does this, in the first place, the average reader would not figure that out.
Yeah.
We figure it out only because he explains it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes Sherlock Holmes Sherlock Holmes and makes us Sherlockians.
Yeah. He's brilliant.
The fact that we couldn't have figured that out. I mean, they've done books where they lead, you know, up to that moment where Holmes describes his method of thought and how he solved the mystery. If you didn't have that, you would have no idea how he figured that.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect way of ending these mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Is when the detective tells you how he figured it out, that's when you say, oh my God,
yeah,
he's brilliant.
And in this case, the final clue for the finding out where they are is that it must have been a high-priced restaurant, the select prices that were on the back of that receipt. 8 shillings for a bed and 8 pence for a glass of sherry. That's an expensive hotel. And I looked at it and I was like, 8 pence for the sherry is expensive. Okay, I get that. But I thought a shilling for a cocktail was really expensive. When I looked, I didn't realize cocktails in the late 19th century would have been that expensive, but apparently they were. And that's it with them. He says, he says to Watson, I invited them to meet me here. His conduct, Lord Robert St. Simon's conduct, to give him his full name there, was certainly not very gracious. I'm sorry, Watson says that. Watson notices that, because Watson's us, and we're supposed to notice that. So it's great that he gives Watson that line. Holmes even gives St. Simon's benefit that. He says, you would not be very gracious either if, after all the trouble of wooing and wedding, you found yourself deprived in an instant of wife and of fortune, as you read to us earlier. He says, we may judge Lord St. Simon very mercifully and thank our stars that we are never likely to find ourselves in the same position. And there's the irony that he's throwing in there, the dig at him. And then it's violin time. My violin Hand me my violin, for the only problem which we still have to solve is how to while away these bleak autumnal evenings.
Great end to the story. Great end to the story. It's I mean, there's nothing about it that jumps out at you, especially, like I was saying at the beginning, coming after Engineer's Thumb and Speckled Band. There's nothing in it that really jumps out at you as being particularly dramatic or anything.
Yeah.
It's just a really well-written and funny story. I mean, as close as the Sherlock Holmes stories come to being comic, this is one of those ones, like Red-Headed League. Only this is obviously, you know, because it's upper-class romance story. Sort of thing, but that's it's really delightful to go back to Noble Bachelor and read it by itself again.
I agree, and that, you know, that kind of little bit of that levity that's all through it. I mean, it just Doyle seems to be on top of his game in creating this dialogue and crafting a story that shouldn't be that interesting into something that. I'm still there all the way through it.
Yeah, likewise.
Well, all righty. Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 13 of Sherlock Mondays. Curtis, I am very happy to have you back for this one. You will return for episode 18, The Adventure of the Cardboard Box.
Speaking of gruesome.
Yeah. So no spoilers yet, but yeah, there you go. Get that one. So you thought you had gruesome with Engineer's Thumb. All righty. When do you get to that one? Coming up next week, on the next episode, Monica Schmidt returns to talk about the adventure of the blue carbuncle. In the words of Christopher Morley, a Christmas story without slush. I can't wait to talk about Blue Carbuncle and celebrate Holmes at Yule time. So thank you to our chat, Mrs. Hudson Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. And again, let me remind you to subscribe to this channel, to like these videos. And if you're listening to the podcast, leave us a review somewhere on whatever platform you're using. That always helps the visibility of these shows. Curtis, I can wish you compliments of the season, as Watson would have done. Everyone, I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Thank you much, everyone. Have a great one.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays, sponsored by Lisa Washington, hosted by Edward G. Pettit, music by Pleated Gazelle.